Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange conference call. Today's call is being recorded. Now for introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Shazan Shadani. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Sarah. Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is Object Request Broker, Problem Determination, and Best Practices. If you have yet not joined the meeting, please do so now. The e-meeting URL is available on the WebSphere Technical Exchange site. Today's webcast will include a PowerPoint presentation. Once you're in the meeting, you'll see the presentation. We recommend that you view the presentation in full screen mode. To do this, go to the view in the toolbar at the top of your screen and select Make Shared Area Full Screen. If you're unable to access the e-meeting at this time, or if you would like to download a copy of the presentation, please go to the WebSphere Technical Exchange site and click on today's presentation title. The docs that displays will contain the PDF file. You may also access the presentation by going to any IBM.com site and typing the tech doc number 7009777 in the search box found at the very top of the page. Once again, the number is 7009777. This call is being recorded, so you can replay it at your convenience. Early next week, the MP3 file along with the presentation will be available on the previous webcast tab of the WebSphere Technical Exchange site. During the presentation, all lines will be muted. After the presentation, I will ask you to respond to a quick few polling questions. At the end of today's session, the lines will open for a quick question-answer period. Today's presenter is Paul Bullis. Paul Bullis has been a member of the WebSphere L2 support organization since March of 2003. He has worked on multiple teams with the L2 support organization and currently is team lead of the SDK group. The SDK team diagnoses hangs, crashes, memory issues, and high CPU problems reported in WebSphere. Before joining the WebSphere support, Paul worked in the AIX L2 support group. There he supported NFS, NIS, DNS, and other networking applications within AIX. Paul studied computer science at West Texas A&M University and Texas Tech University. Technology interests include Linux, Unix, code development, all languages, and OS kernel design. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Paul. Paul?
All right. Thanks, Shazan, for the introduction, and good morning to everyone. On slide two, you're going to find the agenda for today's presentation. Today, we'll discuss the following topics. First, a brief overview and introduction of the orb and how it's used within WebSphere, the differences between the base orb and the extension orb, how to enable orb tracing and where the data gets written, how to read an orb trace and important trace points used for problem determination, the typical orb request flows for applications running in base and also in the network deployment environment, common orb exceptions, and then finally we'll discuss a few best practices to avoid common problems. Slide three. For the purposes of today's presentation, we assume you have a basic understanding of the orb and how it's used within applications. Because the orb is also used within WebSphere, for internal operations, even if you're not using EJBs in your application, being able to understand how to do problem determination in the orb component is still very important. The IBM orb that's shipped within WebSphere is an implementation of the Common Object Request Broker architecture, otherwise known as CORBUS spec, which was developed by the Object Management Group. The orb provides a framework to facilitate the remote calls for objects located on local or remote JVMs, as if those objects were local to where the application was. For example, if I have a servlet that's calling an EJB, the orb provides me the framework to call a method within that EJB, even though the actual Java bean is being hosted on another JVM. As mentioned previously, there are other non-application functions where the orb's used within WebSphere. And one example of this is when app servers are started, they register their object adapters with the node agent process. So if there was a problem during this communication, you may have a symptom of an orb problem that you would need to then diagnose using the PD skills that we're going to talk about today. Slide four. Okay, on slide four, I have created a diagram that just shows some of the component layers that we go through for a typical orb request. It's important to understand the component layers because if there's failures in any one of these layers, it can bubble up to either the application or show up as a orb symptom that you would then need to diagnose. Starting at the top, we have the application code that's running within WebSphere that's either doing a JNDI lookup or an EJB call. This JNDI lookup, if we were using one of these, we'd have an actual extra layer here that I haven't documented, which would be the naming code. But for a typical EJB call, we're going to call directly into the orb. Once in the orb, the component, the second layer that we see there, is actually made up of two pieces. We're going to talk about them later on in the presentation, the base orb and the extension orb. And then within the ORB framework, we also have plugins or interceptors, and these are specialized bit of code that help us do specialized tasks when sending and receiving messages. This extra functionality allows us to handle things like workload management and security, which we see here. Starting on the left, we have the workload management plugin, which provides the workload balancing that you get within a clustered environment for ORB requests going out on the wire. So in this case, you would have an ORB request coming in from the application, and we would use the workload management plugin to get a target or get the next target based on our balancing and routing information to route the request and balance that workload. The workload management plugin relies on the HA manager component, which also relies on a number of other smaller components on top of TCP/IP. So again, if there's problems in any one of these layers, it might show itself up as an ORB symptom within your logs. On the right side, we have the security plugin. So when you're in a secured environment with global security enabled within WebSphere, the security plugin is responsible for adding the security context on and off the ORB message and so that we can authenticate and authorize users. Underneath all of these layers, we have TCP/IP. And because ORB is doing remote calls, it's very important that our TCP/IP layer be working properly. So things like OS-level timeouts, name resolution become very important and can cause problems all the way up the stack. Slide 5. Okay, so as I mentioned on the previous slide, the ORB component or the ORB layer is actually made up of two distinct pieces. You have the base ORB and the extension ORB. The base ORB is the Java implementation of the Corvus spec that's delivered as the IBM ORB within the SDK that's delivered with WebSphere. So because it's delivered in the SDK, if you update your SDK to a new version, then you get a new or updated version of the IBM ORB. The base ORB classes are included in the IBM ORB.jar, and you may be familiar with this file if you've ever worked with support and received a test fix, because the files that we generally hand out for a test fix of the ORB base ORB classes come as a standalone IBM ORB.jar. Because this is dependent on the version of the SDK, they are built and bundled together. So for an official fix, you would get a full SDK installation. I've also included the package names on the bottom of the slide so that when you're looking at a symptom within a log file, like a system out or system error file, we can determine whether or not the problem is within the base ORB or the extension ORB. And this is important depending on the type of strategy you're going to take to diagnose the problem. Finally, the base ORB has a file called ORB.properties, which again is under the same Java the Java path under the WebSphere installation root. And what the ORB.properties contains is the list of interceptors that are going to be registered with the ORB, along with the COM IBM Corbo localhost system property. The system property contains the host name of the server where the ORB is going to be running, and it's very important that this be accurate. This gets populated during the installation of WebSphere when it prompts you for the host name of the server. And if for some reason this is set to localhost and incorrect IP, maybe you have a new IP address that was brought up for a particular server, new host name and IP, and this file needs to be updated so that we have the correct information. As long as the installation was done properly and nothing has changed in your environment and a fully qualified host name or IP address was included, then this should be okay. Typically, problems related to this particular file are strange routing problems where a request, instead of going to a remote server, would be being attempted back on the local system itself, and that's typically when localhost was put in for the host name. Slide 6. The second part of the ORB that we deal with is the extension ORB, and this is the actual WebSphere code that implements the base ORB code, or it instantiates the base ORB instance within the app server. This is where our plugin framework that we talked about earlier with the various plugins that are the value-add pieces for WebSphere to do extra things like transaction service, security, workload management come in. I've also included the extension ORB classes at the bottom. Again, this is to help you diagnose whether or not the problem is coming from the extension ORB or the base ORB. And again, our tracing strategies that we'll talk about later may change depending on which package it's coming from. Slide 7. Okay, now once we've identified from our symptom, either from a system out.log, system error log, or it could even be an error message that you see through the browser from your servlet, a number of different ways. Once we have identified our symptom, we can move on to deciding whether or not we need to enable orb tracing. There's two types of orb tracing, one for each type of the orb component. So we have a base orb and extension orb. You have comm tracing and orb RAS tracing. So the first type we'll talk about is the comm tracing, which is included as part of the base orb itself. Comm tracing looks very much like what you would see from a TCP-style trace. You have a packet header, or an orb packet header, and you have a body. And the body contains the hex representation of the data message going out, the GIOP message. And then on the right side, it has the ASCII representation, so you can actually identify strings, and it's a little more readable. The comm tracing shows incoming and outgoing orb packets. So you can actually follow requests from one server or one trace to another server's trace back and forth. The comm trace is enabled using the following two properties, comm IBM corebug comm trace equals true and comm IBM corebug debug equals true. These can be passed into a standalone client on the Java command line or in the app server through the generic JVM arguments or orb custom properties. It is important that the case be correct based on that because these are case sensitive. We also made it a little easier to enable the orb tracing instead of having to type these properties and enable orb RAS. You can go through the console to the orb service panel, and there's an orb tracing checkbox. When enabled, this will enable comm tracing that we talked about now, as well as the orb RAS tracing we're going to talk about on the next slide. Slide 8. The orb RAS tracing is the WebSphere extension orb tracing that is very much like other tracing that you might see within WebSphere. You have a trace log where the output is written to, and you'll see the output with a timestamp, a thread ID, and then whatever the trace output is going to be, very much like any other component within WebSphere. The orb trace string that we use for orb RAS tracing is orb RAS equals all. Again, this is case sensitive, and on version 5.1 you have to use the older style trace string where the orb RAS all enabled. One of the benefits of orb RAS tracing in problem determination is you may have a case where you have an intermittent orb problem that you can't use or that we can't necessarily restart, or we don't want to have a long-running trace going. So one of the benefits of the WebSphere tracing is that you can enable that as a runtime trace when the problem begins to occur or for a short duration of time, and you can enable it and disable it. So that's in approaching the type of problem that you're going to be diagnosing, you need to keep in mind that this is available and can provide most of the information that you see, not the body of the packets that you see with the comm trace, but a lot of the other information, and we'll actually see some examples of this in following slides, but you can get the majority of the information from the orb RAS trace itself if you don't have the luxury of comm trace. It's definitely more preferred to have both if you can. Both the comm and orb RAS trace will be written to the WebSphere trace log as defined in your trace settings within the admin console for your particular server, not the system out or system error. But if you're running this in a standalone client, you have a file called orbtrc. And then a timestamp.txt file that gets generated every time your app client is started. If you're using the launch client command to launch a client, there is a CC trace log option that can be passed to it to define whatever path that you want for your trace output. Slide 9. Okay, once we have our trace generated and we've started to diagnose our problem, there's a number of trace points within orb RAS that we can use to come up with information not only about the topology but about the requests, and we can actually track requests using it. We'll start first talking about orb RAS. But as I mentioned, it's really optimal to have both orb and comm if possible because it gives you just a more complete picture of what's going on. So starting with the orb RAS trace points of interest, we'll start with the log versions output. Log versions prints the orb and SDK versions during app server startup. So this is going to be towards the very beginning of the trace, and if your traces have rolled over, you could miss these lines. So again, it's important to have a number of historical files set high enough for whatever duration you expect your tracing to occur. If you have a very busy system, obviously these traces are going to grow quite large, so you need more historical files, bigger file sizes. In this output here, we can see that the Java version is the I-142 SR7 version of the SDK, and the OR version also matches. Again, we, because the orb is built and dependent on the JDK classes underneath, these need to be matching. And there's problems every once in a while that will arise where, for whatever reason, maybe an update occurred or somebody has copied an IBM orb.jar to a classes directory and we have one picking up, and you have maybe mismatching orb versions. So you can use these trace outputs to verify that. The second output that we'll talk about is the read properties method output. This dumps the current set of all the orb properties that are gathered from various metadata, places, runtime, command line, however these options are being passed in, and it'll dump them out towards the beginning of the trace. This is really useful when trying to hunt down various problems where we've set a timeout in the console and that timeout's not being honored. Here from the trace and the actual runtime, I can see what the orb believes that setting is set to. Maybe there's some conflicting places where this is set multiple places, either as a generic JVM argument, an orb custom property. And so we can use that to see which one is being picked up here. Starting, we'll look at the top here. We can see that the comm trace has been enabled. I can see the locate request timeout and the request timeout both set to 180 seconds. I can also see that the bootstrap port is set to 9810. So I might use this later on when we start looking at the orb request flows to know that, okay, this port is listening or will be listening on port 9810 once we create the socket for that. We also can see that the listener port is set to 0, which is a dynamic port. So I'm going to be assigned dynamically a port from the OS when the server creates the socket. And finally, towards the bottom, you have the COM IBM Corbo localhost where I can verify that my fully qualified domain name is set properly and shouldn't cause a problem. Slide 10. Okay, on slide 10, we have the create server socket call, which prints the host name and port for each socket opened by the orb to listen for new requests. This is important when trying to determine, number one, what is the actual port that this particular orb instance is listening on, and there's actually more than one port, as we'll talk about. And then also, we can use that to see if there's a problem. Maybe you're having a problem where we have a port conflict, and so I can trace my servers on the same physical box to see which ones are opening ports where and resolve that conflict in the configuration. In the output here, you can see the create server socket call, and then we print the port. In this case, it was port 0 and local port 9810. So we're opening a local host port up for our configuration that says our bootstrap port is 9810. The second output here that we're going to look at is the git connection client call. So now when we're actually moving on to the point of tracing a client output call, the git connection call will give you some information about where the call is going to go and what operation is going to be invoked on that remote server. If you look towards the end of the line, the operation name git properties is the actual method call that's going to be remotely invoked on the target server. And then we also have the host name and port of the target server in the same line. When we receive a message or an incoming message from a client on the server side, we have the create stream object output, which is printed to the orb trace, that will tell you where the connection is coming from, the port, and then which local port we're connecting to. So in this case, the output is coming from 9.3.161.180, port 1151. That's the client. And then locally, that's coming to my port 3105, which would be somewhere in the range of the orb listener address because it's not in a well-known or in a normal area for a bootstrap port. All right, slide 11. When we're creating the request before the git connection, we actually are we're trying to determine whether or not the request is going to be a WLMable request or something that's going to need us to invoke the workload management interceptor. When looking at your trace, you can determine from the create request call whether or not the call itself is going to be a workload management call if you see the underscore WLM appended to the create request output. If this is going to be a workload management request, then we're going to invoke the interceptor. We're going to try to get a target for that, and we could have a problem within that area. So typically, where you're going to be looking at trace output here for create request WLM is when you're having a routing problem to a cluster. And these are typically down in the WLM code, so we would need to additionally get a workload management trace, which we'll talk about a little later as well. But in this case, we can at least narrow down whether this request should be invoking the interceptor or whether it's not a regular request that we get from the initial context data. The client request impl init is a client-side output which prints the request ID and operation on a line. This is for tracking a request. If I don't have the comm tracing enabled, I need a way to be able to uniquely track a request between one client trace and a server trace so that I can follow the flow back and forth until I find where my problem occurs. The nice thing about this output is it gives you the request ID and the operation. The request ID is not unique. I could have more than one request ID 21 in a system, but a combination of the operation name and then later on with the comm trace, you can actually see the message sizes. We can actually uniquely say that this packet on the client-side trace actually matches up with something we're going to look at the server-side trace when we're looking at flows back and forth. Okay, and then the send fragment output from the server side is printed when the server sends an OR fragment back to the client. So when we begin to reply back to the client's request after we've completed our processing of the remote call, then we see the send fragment output. And the reason I included this here is that it matches up, again, the request ID 21 so that I know that this is matching that client request. So I can measure duration between the create stream object that we saw in the previous slide and the send fragment to determine how long the call is taking within the ORB JVM process. Slide 12. Okay, now that we've talked about the ORBRAS trace point, so we can look at the COM trace, which is from the base ORB. Again, it's preferable to have both. There's cases when you can't, but when you'll see from the COM trace, it's a little easier to follow than just the one-line outputs where we're looking at the request IDs and the operation names. The COM trace prints out the GIOT message that we talked about, which is the actual full incoming and outgoing request from the client or as an incoming request to the server. The GIOT message contains a header which has a number of pieces of information that we'll see an example of this on the next slide that help us uniquely identify this packet, find out where the packet's coming from and going to, what operation's being called, and then the size of the message and whether or not it's a fragment. The GIOT message type can be a locate request message, locate reply message, or reply. A locate request and a locate reply have to do when we're looking for an object. We're not actually trying to invoke the object. The request and reply is when we're actually calling or remotely invoking the operation itself. There's two different timeouts that affect both of these, the locate request timeout and locate and request timeout. So it's important to know if you're looking at a client or a request failure and we're waiting on a server to respond after a certain period of time, which timeout is being honored in that case. And so from the ORB trace and COM trace that we're looking at, we can determine whether or not it's a locate request or a request. All right, each outgoing request from the client will have a matching incoming request on the server if the ORB message is actually making it to the other side. When looking at that, you can match up with the COM trace, again, the incoming and outgoing based on the ports and the request ID. But if you're using Global Security and SSL, the outgoing remote port won't match up what you see on the incoming side, and that's because we're using a special listen port for SSL transaction for confidentiality. There is an output in the ORBRAS trace connection table impl get connection that will give the correct port if you need to find it, but there's other ways to match these up as well, not just the ports. You can use the request ID, the operation, and the message size, along with the time, the relevance of the two times in both sides of the traces if the times are synced on the server. And finally, at the bottom, I've included a link in the Info Center to an article that details the COM trace and talks about each one of the different parts that we'll go over in the next slide. Okay, slide 13. On slide 13, I have an example header from a COM trace output. This is not including the body, which I said represented the data that was actually contained within the packet because that can actually get quite large. But in this case, the header is really the important part for following the ORB request flow between a client and a server. All right, starting at the top, I can see this is an incoming message, so I'm receiving this from some other process. I could be a client in this case, or I could be a server, but somebody is either replying to something I sent, or this is a new request coming to me. In this case, I can see from the GApp message type that this is a request message. It's the second line in the trace. The third line is the actual timestamp. And again, if you're in a synced time environment, then these are easy and you can rely on these times to get proximity when looking at different traces. But if you're in something where the times are not synced or you're going across time zones and everything is maybe data centers in one part of the country to another, you have to rely on other parts of the message header to really uniquely identify this packet and know that you're following the same packet back and forth. We have the local port and local IP, and that's the of the OR process itself that's receiving the message. And then we have the remote port and IP, and that's, the in this case, the client or whoever's replying back to us. The fragment, which is highlighted in red, is also will tell you whether or not there is going to be another fragment coming or not. By default, the OR fragment size is 1K. So if the OR message exceeds that size, then we're going to create another fragment, and this would be fragment to follow yes. On the last fragment of the request, you'll see a fragment to follow no always. You can also track your fragments using the request ID because each one of the fragments is still part of the same request. So the request ID can be used for that or can be used to, again, uniquely identify a request going back and forth between two app server processes. And finally, at the bottom, we see the operation, create, which tells us the actual method call being invoked on the remote side. Another item of interest would be the method size if you're looking at something related to fragmenting and wanting to know how big the OR request message is. Maybe you're looking at a performance issue, and so the combination of all the fragments that make up one request may help you in tuning your fragment size. All right, slide 14. Okay, on slide 14, I have a side-by-side output from two different traces that were taken. One is the client, and one is the server side receiving the request. So we can see in this case, this was a locate request message going out to port 9900, which is the node agent's ORB listener address from a client running on the local host on 3305. And then on the right side, you can see the local port and remote port are just flip-flopped along with the IP address, so we can match these two requests up. We also see that the request ID is 6, and that the date is close because these are run on the same physical system. So I can now follow this request and see that I'm going from one trace to the other. And this becomes really important when looking at any type of problem where we have to go back and forth between two servers and we're trying to find out where the problem occurs. The client may be throwing the symptom, but the server may be where the actual problem is happening. Another thing to mention is that you don't always necessarily know, especially in a clustered environment, where your client is talking to because we get routed to many different servers. So in trying to decide which server I'm going to trace, you may run the trace on the client first, find out which server we were talking to when the problem occurred, and then turn on trace on that server. Okay, slide 15. So when looking at a ORB request flow problem, maybe your actual ORB requests are going to the wrong server or a server that's unexpected. Maybe we have a security issue because you're going to a server that's not protected and you're expected to go to somewhere that's within your same cell that has the same security configuration. All these types of cases, it's important to understand just what is the normal flow so that you can compare your trace against what is expected. These change depending on whether or not you're talking to a base or standalone app server or a network deployment environment with a clustered app. The first request flow that we'll look at is the standalone environment. I've included the trace or the actual code snippet at the bottom of the slide that will show you the five lines of code that, or the four lines of code that result in the remote ORB calls. Something else to note here is the provider URL, and a very common misconception is that whatever I have listed in my provider URL is the only server that I'm going to be dealing with, and that's not the case. The provider URL gives you the initial context point where I'm going to connect to first to get into the naming service of the cell. Once I'm there, I'm going to be routed around to many different app servers or many different points depending on what this is. Because we're talking about a standalone app server in this particular case, it's going to be the same JVM process, but we're going to talk to even multiple ports within that process. Slide 16. Okay, on slide 16, I've documented the, I took this information directly from a client-side Comtrace and a server-side Comtrace and just extracted it out so that you can see the flow back and forth for a normal call. In this case, we're doing an EJB create, which is really three operations that we're going to do, or four operations. You have your initial context. You have the lookup of the actual home interface for the EJB, and then we're going to do a create against that interface. We could also do a method call, a remove, but in this case, we stop at the create. So starting at the top, we can follow back and forth the client-side output call to the server and then its reply back. In the first case, when you're doing the initial context, we're looking for the WSN name service object, which runs in the wherever the location service daemon is running within your cell. In this case, in a standalone app server, it's a cell of one, so it's only going to be running in server one. So the first call goes out to the port 2810 of the server of server one, which we specified on our provider URL. And the reply back from the server is an object forward. And that's because the bootstrap port is not actually going to answer our naming or our location service request. It's just going to a well-known port that will then redirect you to where the orb listener is running. So we get the object forward, and our next call out is to port 9101, which is the orb listener address for server 1. It replies back and says the naming service is here with the object here message, and you actually see these in the Comtrace output when you see a reply or incoming or outgoing reply from a server. And finally, we do the get properties method call, which is actually getting our initial context data, and again, this is using port 9101 because that's where the orb listener address is. The second groupings of calls is the actual lookup itself. And when you're dealing with a standalone environment, we're going to do a locate request before each one of our calls. So in this case, we do a locate request to port 9101, looking for the looking to see if the server LSD is there, and it replies back and says it is. And then our next call is resolve complete info, which is the actual JNDI lookup. So that's where our JNDI name would be passed to the resolve complete info method, and then we return with the information about how we can get to that particular object. Finally, once we have that the information or the IOR that will give us the target of where we need to go to look up the particular EJB, we can now call a create and start by doing a locate request to make sure that that EJB exists on the server. It replies back that it does, and then we finally call a create and get our instance of the beam. So this flow looks very complicated, but when you're going through that, you'll see this duplicated over and over for all types of orb requests. So once you understand this in a standalone environment, you can go apply this to many other traces, and you're going to always see these same type of flows between when invoking a remote EJB or doing a lookup for a JMS connection object, JDBC connection object, anything like that. Okay, moving on to slide 17. The difference in this next case is we're going to be calling a network deployment cluster. So this is where we have an EJB that's deployed to a cluster of app servers as opposed to just a standalone app server, and we have a client looking up that particular EJB. So the same code that you saw previously in red is still going to result in our orb calls. The only difference here, and I wanted to point this out, is the provider URL. I added a second or a failover host and port for the provider URL. And again, this doesn't mean that I'm going to be going to these ports and these ports only to do this lookup and this invoke of the EJB. What it means is that these are the failover ports or the initial context ports that we'll use to initially get into the naming service in the cell. For example, if my app server running on port 9811 was down during the initial context, I would then switch over to use 9812 after we detected the comm failure so that my client could still connect to something. Now, if we've already gotten past that initial context and one of those app servers goes down, we're going to use our workload management or routing data that we have from the initial context to then recover from that problem, and then we'll go to one of the other processes in the cell that can service the request. Slide 18. Okay, this again looks a lot like what you saw on the previous orb request flow output, except you'll notice it's actually one request shorter. And when you're in a network deployment environment, the LSD or location service daemon, instead of running within the server process, runs within the node agent. It's a very common question we get at support is why the client is trying to connect to the node agent, and that's because we need to connect to the node agent during the initial context to get the cluster data and other information and routing information about the cell. So starting at the top, again, we have the locate request looking for the WSN name service. That's always going to be the first packet that you see out because we have to first find where the WSN name service is so that we can do the rest of our request. And again, we get forwarded to the orbital listener address of the app server. In this case, the app server is able to give you the initial context data, and so we get that data, and we can then move on to the lookup itself. In this case, you'll see that the lookup is going to port 9900, which is the node agent orb listener address, which was different from the last case because that's where the location service name is running. Now, once we look up that or we make that call to the node agent's orb listener address and it provides us the information, we can then go to the target server itself. In this case, it was cluster member 1 orb listener address to do the actual lookup for the EGB. Once we have that lookup information, the next step is to do a create. But because we're in a cluster, something interesting happens here. You can see that our next call goes to cluster member 2. So this is the actual balancing that's going on with the data that we received during the initial context for the cluster. So you can also use your orb trace or contracing to verify that workload management is balancing properly, because every WLMable request will go back and forth between your cluster members evenly. Another misconception is that you're going to only do the creates or the method calls themselves back and forth, but it's actually the JNDI lookup as well as the create, the remove, and then any method calls. So all of those different items are workload balanced when dealing with a cluster. Okay, next slide, slide 19. Okay, so we have, I've included a link to our troubleshooting guide from the IBM support site that has a list of common orb exceptions and some solutions. Now, a lot of orb exceptions are very high level and can have many root cause problems that may not be in the orb area or could be very difficult. So if you're just looking at a APAR symptom and thinking that that it maps one-to-one to this particular problem, more than likely it doesn't. You have to find out from an orb trace or from doing some further problem determination what the root cause of the problem is, and then look for an APAR or look at some tech node or something that could explain why that's occurring. There's also some exceptions I've listed here that are not orb-related. The first one sets are workload management exceptions, but because they have CORBA in their name, people will try to diagnose these as orb problems first and usually spend a lot of time gathering orb traces only to find out that you need workload management traces or some other layer. So it's important that if you receive any one of the three that I have listed, the no available target, no cluster data, or signal retry, that you know that these are workload management exceptions, and more than likely we're going to have to diagnose WLM as well. So this can save you some time when trying to decide how you're going to pursue tracing. We also have the same issue with the security exception, org OMG CORBA no permission. An orb trace alone won't tell you why the actual authentication failed on the remote server. You have to get a security trace or SAS trace along with that. So again, these are included in the common orb exceptions and problems link at the top of the slide. Okay, slide 20. Finally, we're going to talk about a number of best practices, and not all of these apply necessarily to every environment, and there's different reasons why you would want to do these, but these are common problems that we see that have pretty simple solutions that can really make your system, in the case of the hard-coded app server or orb listener address ports, more bulletproof and more able to handle unknown events. So the first one we're going to talk about is the orb clients and servers, or to use orb clients and servers that are the same WebSphere and SDK version. When going between major versions of the JDK, for example, if I have a client running on a 5.10 app server, which is using the 1.41 JDK, calling a 1.42 JDK or higher, I could run into interoperability problems that we may have APARs out there for already, but you know, just to save yourself some time, if you're running at the same level or same level of code, these type of interoperability issues typically don't occur. So on the same token, if you're using different versions of the SDK itself, the clients and servers have to do a callback to actually work out some of the interoperability details. And what that means is when I create a socket to the app server, remote app server, the app server would actually call back my client on a different port. And if I'm in a firewall scenario where I have ports blocked or only allowing the orb listener address port and the bootstrap port of the target servers open in the firewall, I can run into a case where I'm going to get a comm failure because the app server is trying to connect back to the client through a port that's not open. The second best practice that we don't see very often, but when it does occur, it can be quite frustrating, is when there's applications running within WebSphere that are calling the orb.init method. There's cases in which this can work, but the cases where it doesn't are when we're using hard-coded ports or global security where by default, the ports are hard-coded for the SSL ports. And what happens is, because the app server's already initted the orb once, and we used all the configuration from WebSphere to create that instance of the orb, if an application comes along and makes another call to orb.init, you can run into port conflicts and get messages about ports already being in use. We actually have documented in the Info Center the proper way to get an orb instance when running within the app server process using JNDI lookups. And the app server provides that for any application that needs it. But most of the time, there's not a need to do that unless you're actually creating your orb message directly instead of just calling an EJB method where it's all handled under the covers. And finally, hard-coding the app server orb listener address ports as a best practice. This isn't feasible in all environments, and if you're in a really big environment with hundreds of app servers or even multiple app servers on a single physical box, this adds a bit of management overhead. What it does fix, though, is the unknown cases where you may have an app server go down or you have an application client that caches initial context data up front. And because it's not checking with the node agent each time for new initial context data, if one of those app servers goes down in the target cell, the client will keep trying to connect to the old dynamic orb listener port that was created previously and provided. If you hard code those ports, even if the client, even if the target server comes up and doesn't re-register with the node agent or does, our client can still connect to it because it still has the same port it was using previously. So if you're looking to just reduce some of the unknowns that can occur with dynamic ports, hard coding the port is a better idea. It just adds a layer of overhead that you have to maintain. Okay, slide 21, summary. Today we talked about the difference between the base orb and extension orb, how to enable orb tracing and where the data is written, how to read an orb trace and follow a request from a client to a server, typical orb request flows in both base and the indie environment using the EJB create example, common orb exceptions that are not due to orb problem, where to find orb exceptions on our troubleshooting guide. And finally, the best practices to avoid the orb problems. Okay, slide 22. This chart includes the links to a number of sites to provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth and technical information, and the events links on the support site points you to webcast and conference information. WebSphere.org can be used to find web user group information and more product information about WebSphere itself. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. And the ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. Finally, the My Support link on the product page lets you sign up for free weekly email updates of products that interest you, and I highly recommend that to receive all the flashes and updates about WebSphere and any other products that you use. Slide 23. Okay, the presentation is complete, and we'll go ahead and move on to the polling questions and Q&A.
Certainly. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please ensure that your mute function is turned off before pressing the corresponding digit. Once again, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question. And we'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue. At this time, we have no responses. However, I would like to leave the audience with another reminder that it is star 1 for questions. And, gentlemen, it appears that this time we have no questions.
At this time, we would like to conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope that you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today. And thank you, Paul, for presenting today.